Hello and welcome to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Belinda Walia. Today we're welcoming back Dr. Nicholas Jenner for a deeper conversation about codependency, relationships and the nervous system. Dr. Nicholas Jenner is a psychotherapist specializing in areas including codependency, attachment, trauma, and relationships. And today we're going to explore why these patterns can feel so difficult to change and why relationships uncertainty can create such powerful reactions and how we can begin moving from automatic responses towards greater awareness, regulation, and choice. Nick, it's great to welcome you back to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Belinda. It's very nice to be here again.
It's my pleasure. Now, Nick, you describe codependency as more than a set of behaviours and suggest that it can be understood as a nervous system pattern. What do you mean by that?
We do talk about people pleasing, rescuing, poor boundaries, and overgiving, and that's a very important part of the codependent set. These things are obviously very important to look at in therapy, but for me, they don't quite answer the question of why somebody feels so compelled to behave that way. And that's where the nervous system comes in. You know, if I've learned that relationships require me to monitor other people and keep everything stable, then conflict, silence, distance or uncertainty can create a genuine threat response in the body. I may become anxious. I may feel an urgency to do something about it. So I might explain, apologize, chase that person, reassure, fix or abandon a boundary. And once the relationship seems settled again, I will feel better. Yeah, what I've actually done is regulate my internal distress by managing the relationship. And that's an important distinction because suddenly codependency isn't simply, why can't you stop people pleasing? A better question is, what does your nervous system believe will happen if you stop?
I think that's such an important point, and it's fascinating, Nick, and it's an important distinction. I think it shifts the focus from judging the behavior to actually understanding what is driving it, and that awareness can be incredibly powerful when we're trying to change these patterns. So how can childhood experiences such as inconsistency and criticism and that emotional withdrawal, having to monitor parents' moods, shape the way somebody behaves in adult relationships? Because obviously we know that this is learned behavior more than anything else.
Well, yes, with everything codependency, you've got to go back to childhood. It's okay dealing with behaviours in the present day, but actually, you know, the childhood is where it all starts. And, you know, we have to remember that children are completely dependent upon the adults around them. You know, so maintaining connection is incredibly important. You know, and as a child, if you're fortunate enough to grow up in a reasonably predictable environment, you know, you gradually learn that relationships are safe, that people can be upset without disappearing, and that conflict doesn't mean everything is about to fall apart. But just imagine this, growing up where you don't know which version of a parent you're going to get. You know, perhaps there's anger, criticism, withdrawal, or simply emotional inconsistency. In that case, a child becomes very good at monitoring the environment. They notice tone of voice, facial expressions, and silence. They learn when to speak and when to stay quiet. So the child adapts. You know, one child becomes helpful, another becomes invisible, another becomes the peacemaker or the mediator, and another becomes perfectionist because making mistakes feels dangerous. You know, I don't see those initially as dysfunctional behaviours, they're adaptations. The difficulty is that we carry them into adulthood long after the original environment has disappeared. You know, so now you're 30, 40, 50 years old, but part of your nervous system is still operating according to an old rule. If I want closeness, I need to remain vigilant.
And that's such an interesting way of putting it, Nick. And thank you. I think it really shows how behaviours we may struggle with as adults can once have been very intelligent ways of adapting and maintaining connection as children. And I think that's also a very important point, because we can be living in the present while our nervous system is still responding to the rules it learned decades ago, which is why awareness, again, of those patterns is so important. So why can somebody understand their codependent patterns, like we're talking about it today, and they may reflect on it and say, aha, I understand that, I get why I am the way I am. But somebody can understand their codependent patterns extremely well and still find themselves repeating exactly the same behavior when they are triggered. Why is that?
Well, I see this all the time in therapy. I mean, somebody can tell me exactly what their codependent pattern is. They've read all the normal books that you would, you know, associate with codependency. They've done therapy in the past. They understand their childhood and they know they shouldn't send that second message or abandon the boundary they've just set. Then something happens and they do exactly what they said, you know, what they said they weren't going to do. The reason is that intellectual understanding and nervous system learning aren't the same thing. The nervous system responds incredibly quickly. By the time you're consciously thinking about what has happened, your body may already be activated and telling you what you need to do, you need to do something. So this isn't necessarily a lack of awareness. In fact, some people have enormous awareness, and some people can tell me more about codependency than I know. The problem is moving from awareness into action. Now, that term there, awareness into action, is one of the key elements of therapy. And it's a subject for my upcoming online therapy groups in October. And I'm also developing an app with exactly that name, awareness into action, where you take your awareness and you move into action and you regulate that action. You know, the idea behind that is that the nervous system needs new experiences. It needs to experience setting a boundary and surviving the discomfort. It needs to experience not chasing reassurance and discovering that the anxiety eventually comes down on its own. That's why I often say that awareness tells us what we're doing, but repeated action, sometimes in very small steps, teaches the nervous system that we don't have to keep doing it.
Absolutely. And thank you for sharing that, Nick. And I am excited for you that you're creating this app and these groups. And I think those small repeated experiences are so important. And what people would learn in the groups and apps is, I'm sure it will be exactly what they need. Each time we respond differently, we're gradually building trust in ourselves and learning that discomfort doesn't have to dictate our behavior. And I think it's really important that people understand this about themselves. So for me, the real transformation happens when we can take that awareness and practice responding differently in the moments when those old patterns are actually activated. So thank you for sharing that, Nick. What is actually happening in the nervous system when a partner becomes distant or goes quiet or doesn't reply to a message and the other person suddenly feels compelled to fix the situation?
Well, we've got to remember that the nervous system is constantly scanning for information. That's its job. It's, you know, it's come from childhood where it's done the same thing, and it's doing the same in adulthood. You know, much of that happens outside of conscious awareness. You know, we're noticing facial expressions, tone, distance, silence, and changes in behavior. You know, if somebody has learned that those things can signal relational danger, a relatively small event can activate a much bigger response. So let's take a very common example, a very modern example. Somebody hasn't replied to a message. The fact is simply that they haven't replied, but the body reacts. The stomach tightens, breathing changes, attention narrows, and anxiety starts to rise. Then the mind kicks in and tries to explain the feeling. They're angry with me. I've done something wrong. They're losing interest, or they're going to leave, which is the most common one. Now there's an urge to act, which goes through the whole system and into the body. Send another message. Check whether they're online. Explain something. Seek reassurance. That's why the present trigger can sometimes look completely disproportionate to the reaction. A trigger may be happening now, but the alarm system responding to it can be very, very old.
And that's when people spiral, don't they? Because the familiar patterns that they have of old relationships, for example, that triggers that old alarm system, as you said. And I think it's incredibly powerful as well. Sometimes we're not simply reacting to what is happening now, but to what our nervous system has embedded in it, and that has learned to anticipate a disaster, for example, that, and we go into fight or flight mode.
Exactly.
So you make the point that codependent people may regulate their own distress by managing the relationship. But how does that process work?
I'd just like to come back to something you just said in the last answer there. You mentioned fight or flight, which is absolutely correct. But I mean, in codependency, there's often a couple more, which are actually more common. And that's freeze and it's fawn. So fawn is the ultimate adaptation. So you monitor the room, you find out what you think that person needs or the kind of image that you need to present, and you compensate by creating that. Codependents are great at that. The other one, freeze, is when, you know, codependents just distance themselves and shut down. But those two are also very common, apart from the fight or flight. So coming back to your question, and I think regulating by managing is one of the most important aspects of codependency. We all accept that managing the relationship is part of that process. Now, we can say it like this. You know, something happens in the relationship that creates uncertainty. You know, the nervous system becomes activated and the body experiences anxiety, guilt, fear, or urgency. The person doesn't like the feeling, so they need to do something to change the relationship. You know, perhaps they apologize, perhaps they become more accommodating, they send another message, they over-explain themselves, and anything to make the other person feel better. Then the other person responds, you know, positively, and suddenly the problem is gone. The issue is that the nervous system has just learned something. It's learned that when a person feels anxious about a relationship, managing the other person makes the anxiety go away. So the next time it happens, the urge is even stronger. What looks from the outside like somebody being excessively concerned with another person can literally be an attempt to regulate themselves. They're trying to make the outside world safe enough for the inside world to settle, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And thank you for sharing that. I think it's such a interesting and fascinating topic, and it makes so much sense. When our sense of safety becomes dependent on another person's response, we can lose sight of our own ability to regulate ourselves, which is such an important part of breaking that cycle. So Nick, thank you. There's so much to unpack here, particularly the idea that what we may interpret simply as a relationship behavior can actually be connected to something happening much deeper within the nervous system. We're going to take a short pause now for a word from our sponsors. Stay with us. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Belinda Walia, and today I'm joined once again by the incredible Dr. Nicholas Jenner. We're exploring codependency through the lens of the nervous system and attachment in relationships, and why knowing what our patterns are doesn't necessarily make them easy to change. Nick, let's continue. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nick, why can ordinary disagreement or another person's disappointment feel so threatening to somebody with codependent patterns?
Well, I think we're getting to the crux of the matter here, and I think we can mention at this point, and I've often heard from clients that when they've gone to therapy and talked about this, there's been an emphasis on behavior, and I think, without really looking at where that's coming from. And it is true that that codependency isn't understood by a lot of people and also a lot of therapists. But this is the crux of the problem. When something happens in a relationship like this, how is it perceived by the nervous system? Because disagreement isn't always experienced by codependents simply as disagreement. If you grew up in a family where conflict was followed by anger, punishment, withdrawal or silent treatment, your nervous system may have learned that conflict threatens connection. And then you carry that association into adulthood. So your partner says something quite innocent, like, "I'm disappointed that you don't want to do this." And consciously, the person may know that they're entitled to be disappointed, but the nervous system hears something much bigger. "They're unhappy with me. Something is wrong between us. I need to fix this." So that's why some codependent people avoid conflict almost completely. There are codependents who come into the first session with me and say, "Our relationship can't be that bad because we never fight." That to me is a very alarming statement, because conflict is part of a healthy relationship if it's handled correctly. Codependents avoid conflict, some rush to repair it before anything has actually been resolved. A major part of recovery is learning that somebody can disagree and remain connected. Somebody can be disappointed and the person doesn't have to remove their disappointment. Another person's emotional discomfort doesn't automatically constitute an emergency. So this is the crux of what we're talking about here. All of these normal kind of things that happen in adult relationships are being seen by the nervous system as a major threat.
I think healthy relationships need to have room for disagreement as well, and I totally agree with you there. But we often tell people with codependency that they need better boundaries. Why is setting the boundary sometimes easier than tolerating what happens emotionally afterwards?
Well, you have to remember that when you're dealing with codependence, you're dealing with a very, very special, special situation. And this is where I think a lot of advice that codependents get from, sources completely misses the point. And when you talk to codependents about boundaries, they know what a boundary is. Often they know exactly what they need to say. They know the wording. The real difficulty starts when, when they've said it. Imagine that one of them finally says no to somebody, and the other person becomes disappointed or slightly distant, and then immediately the codependent will feel guilty. So they start thinking, "Oh, was I selfish? Was I too harsh? Should I explain why I said no?" And that process going on for a short time, it's okay. It's just your internal mechanism kind of, seeing that you did the right thing. And that, but with a codependent, they, because of this anxiety they feel around the relationship, they'll start softening the boundary. And, you know, they may remove it altogether, you know. And the paradox is, as soon as they do that, they start to feel better. And that's the important part. Yeah, the nervous system has learned that abandoning a boundary reduces anxiety. So recovery isn't just learning how to say no. It's learning how to say no and then tolerating the guilt, uncertainty, or anxiety that follows without automatically reversing that decision. You know, the real boundary work usually starts after the boundary has been set. And, you know, most of the softening and, you know, and kind of dismantling of boundaries is done on impulse because that's how the nervous system works. So if you can get that person to delay that impulse and sit in that discomfort and prove to themselves they can get through it, then, of course, you know, the boundary can be maintained. And it often has to be maintained the second or maybe even third time.
Yes. And I think, again, that's a really important distinction as well. A boundary isn't only about having the confidence to say no. It's also about trusting ourselves enough to sit with the discomfort afterwards without feeling we have to undo it. And I think that ability to pause rather than immediately act on the discomfort is incredibly powerful, because that's where we begin to move from an automatic reaction to a conscious choice. So how does attachment fit into our understanding of codependency and the nervous system, Nick?
Well, attachment is fundamentally about safety and connection. You know, this is what children are looking for when they come into the world. They're looking for a safe, and this is why they try to bond with their parents. But the child who experiences, you know, reasonably consistent care gradually learns that, you know, distress can be soothed, that people generally remain available, and that temporary separation or disagreement doesn't mean the relationship has disappeared. That's secure attachment. Yeah. But when care is inconsistent, you know, it could be frightening, conditional, or emotionally unavailable, the child can learn something very different. They may learn, I have to work for closeness. I need to monitor people. I shouldn't upset anybody. I need to make myself useful or, you know, or exceptional. Those expectations can become, you know, solid templates for adult relationships. Yeah, that's why something apparently minor, such as a delayed reply or a partner needing some space, can produce such a powerful response. It isn't necessarily just about what's happening today. An older attachment system has been activated through the nervous system. And this is also why reassurance doesn't always work. The adult mind may hear somebody saying everything's fine, but the body and the younger mind isn't necessarily convinced.
And that's really fascinating, isn't it, Nick? I think it really highlights how our earliest experiences of safety and connection can really shape what we come to expect from relationships, and even what we believe we have to do to be loved. And ultimately, the deeper sense of safety has to be developed within ourselves rather than continually seeking it from someone else. And I think I love the way that you're explaining all of this. So thank you for that. And you distinguish between attraction and activation. How can somebody begin to tell whether they are experiencing genuine intimacy and attraction or nervous system urgency?
Well, I think this is a fascinating area, because activation can be incredibly powerful. We all know about the honeymoon period at the beginning of a relationship, when our common sense goes out of the window, and everything like brain chemical hormones and and everything else that's in our brain starts to open us up for attraction. You know, that to me is a time when no big decisions about a relationship should be made, like buying a house, having a child, getting married. But you'll be surprised how many times that happens. And I try to help clients to take things slow, get over that honeymoon period by actually enjoying it, because after that there's real people will emerge, and then you have to decide whether that real person is somebody that you can work with. You know, that doesn't mean it's negative, but a real, more realistic kind of view of that person will come along. So if we go back to that honeymoon period and you're a codependent, you meet somebody who is inconsistent or very difficult to read. Yeah, sometimes they're very available and sometimes they just disappear. Suddenly you're thinking about them constantly. You're checking your phone, there's anticipation, anxiety, and then enormous relief when they contact you again. So it's very easy to call that chemistry, you know?
Yeah.
But I think we need to ask a different question. Am I becoming closer to this person, or am I becoming increasingly activated by them? Intimacy develops through knowing somebody. It involves consistency, trust, repair, and being able to remain yourself within the relationship, something that codependents sometimes know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
And activation tends to contain urgency. I need to know where I stand. I need them to reply. I need to secure this connection. So one useful question is, do I actually feel safe with this person? Are they consistent? Can I trust them? Or am I continually trying to make the relationship feel safe? You know, intensity isn't necessarily intimacy, and urgency isn't necessarily love. But codependents see urgency in particular and intensity as love, and they treat it like love.
Thank you for sharing that, Nick. I think between genuine intimacy and activation, there's an interesting distinction made there. And I think sometimes we can mistake emotional intensity for connection, when a healthy relationship should also allow us to feel secure and remain ourselves within it. And the intensity can feel exciting and convincing, but it's consistency, trust, and emotional safety that allow genuine love and intimacy to grow. And I think once you do start this group, this is something that can be covered. I think that's a really important subtopic, if that's a word. talk about, because I think it'll be really interesting for those people to learn. Now, why can emotionally inconsistent or unavailable people feel particularly compelling to somebody with codependent tendencies, while a calm and consistent relationship may initially feel less exciting?
I'd like to say, Belinda, that I hear this so often. You often get somebody in the early stage of therapy who's absolutely fascinated in chasing this, what can be actually termed from the outside as someone who is moving in the other direction. And yet when they meet somebody who is consistent and wants to be there for them, they find those people boring and not very exciting. And that's because the nervous system is strongly influenced by familiarity. You know, if your early experience of connection involved uncertainty, earning affection, or monitoring another person's emotional state, an inconsistent relationship can feel strangely familiar. You get the chase, the uncertainty, and then the relief when connection returns. And this is why when we talk about, people that are involved with emotionally unavailable people, there's that element of push-pull where, the person goes away and then comes back again, goes away. And in that time when they're away, the other person is just waiting for that reinforcement, that positive energy of them returning again. Yeah. And that's a very powerful emotional cycle. And then you meet somebody who's consistent. You send a text and they reply. They mean what they say. They're emotionally available. And there isn't the same chase. And strangely, somebody can interpret that calmness as a lack of chemistry. And we all know that codependency chemistry is love. It doesn't mean that codependent people consciously want unhealthy relationships. And many of them, in therapy say, I've got to get away from this person, but they don't seem to be able to. It means their nervous system may recognize instability more readily than stability. And sometimes calm initially feels flat because the nervous system has learned to associate love with struggle. And part of recovery is learning that safety can become attractive too. And the ultimate goal, of course, for any codependent, and I firmly believe that the antidote to codependency is not drugs, it's not, you know, anything other than personal autonomy. Finding yourself within the relationship, having your own individual life, and having a space in your life for a relationship. Not spending all your time in the relationship and neglecting anything to do with yourself.
Absolutely, Nick. And I think personal autonomy is such a powerful way to frame recovery. And it's about being able to stay connected to another person without abandoning yourself. That's so important. Your needs, your sense of who you are. You got to know your own identity and be self-aware, be self-accepting and self-compassionate. Nick, thank you so much for your valuable insight. I think that distinction between genuine connection and nervous system activation is particularly interesting, because what feels intense isn't necessarily what is healthy or secure. And we're going to pause to take another commercial break for a word from our sponsors. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Belinda Walia, and we're continuing our fascinating conversation with the amazing Dr. Nicholas Jenner about codependency, relationships, and the nervous system. Welcome back, Nick.
Thank you, Belinda.
Now, Nick, there is a great deal of discussion about narcissistic partners and narcissistic abuse. Why do you think focusing entirely on the other person's pathology can sometimes prevent somebody from understanding their own relational patterns?
Yes, I think this is a very important point. You cannot separate the two subjects, codependency and narcissism. Though I would like to say that not everybody who ends a relationship with a codependent is a narcissist, as tends to be the view of a codependent. And I, again, hear that all the time. Yeah, and I think that we need to be very careful with this, because there are absolutely people out there who are manipulative, controlling, and abusive. And we have to remember that, you can really only call someone a narcissist if they've been, examined by a licensed professional. But understanding the experience of being with those kind of people is extremely important in therapy. My concern is when diagnosing the other person becomes the entire explanation for the relationship, which it often does. If everything is explained by, they were a narcissist, or, we may never ask, why was I compelled to be in this particular relationship? Why did I tolerate so much uncertainty? You know, why was I continually trying to earn connection and saving the relationship? And most crucially, why did I stay when I, you know, when I knew that the relationship was repeatedly activating me? You know, those questions don't excuse the other person's behavior, but they give agency back to the person asking them. You know, I can't necessarily change the person I was involved with, but I can understand what was happening in me is the main thought that should be happening here. And that's crucial, because otherwise we can leave one dysfunctional relationship and eventually recreate the same emotional dynamic with somebody else, which codependents often do, and very quickly after the end of another of the previous relationship. Yeah, the face changes, but the pattern remains.
Yes, and again, I've come across this often myself, where people, I think that phrase that you said, the face changes but the pattern remains, is incredibly powerful, because unless we understand what's happening within us, we can unknowingly recreate the same dynamic in a different relationship. And as I said earlier, I've come across this often myself. So Nick, how have smartphones and messaging apps, and in particular social media, intensified relationship anxiety? As people obviously come across certain behavior patterns and they think, that person, I see it in my partner, and that person might be narcissistic, or they have certain patterns of behavior within themselves that they recognize, particularly for people who seek reassurance or are already hypervigilant, how can it impact them? What intensifies these patterns?
Well, imagine there's someone with an already hypervigilant nervous system has suddenly a great deal of material to work with. Yeah, we can see that somebody has read a message, particularly on WhatsApp, the blue ticks, but hasn't replied. Yeah, we can see that they're online. We can see what they've liked, who they've followed, and whether they've responded to something we've posted. Yeah, for someone with codependent tendencies or attachment anxiety, the phone can almost become a relationship monitoring device. The temptation is to keep checking, because checking promises certainty. Yeah, maybe they'll see something that reassures them. You know, but every time they check, they're also telling their nervous system that there's something important here that needs monitoring. You know, so technology hasn't created attachment insecurity, but it's created almost unlimited opportunities to activate it. You know, and the key is really to learning to tolerate not knowing, and you know, and that's the key thing. I mean, and of course it's a big, big modern problem, you know, how smartphones can give us access to some, you know, some things that we didn't have access to many, many years ago.
And I think that's particularly relevant in relationships today. Technology, what you shared about technology, it gives us endless opportunities to seek reassurance, but learning to tolerate uncertainty without constantly checking is where we begin to regain that emotional control. And we, as you mentioned, we have access to so much information that previous generations simply didn't have, and for someone who is already hypervigilant, that can make it much harder to switch off and trust what they don't know. So thank you for sharing that. Now Nick, you argue that codependency also lives in the body. What physical effects do you commonly associate with prolonged rational vigilance and nervous system activation?
Well, this is where I believe that, you know, many people miss the point when it comes to codependency generally. There are lots of books have been written about, as we've said, behavior, about where codependency comes from. But codependents live that every day through their body. Yeah, so if you're constantly monitoring other people's moods and preparing for possible conflict or rejection, that isn't just happening in your thoughts or your brain. Your body is also participating in it. You know, people can experience muscle tension, shallow breathing, lots of kind of gut issues, you know, even going as far as disturbed sleep, you know, headaches, fatigue, and, you know, and difficulty relaxing. And I'm sure some of those things have been diagnosed with something completely different. You know, and some people describe being absolutely exhausted, but still unable to switch off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes sense because rest requires some sense of safety. You know, if your nervous system has learned that you need to remain alert because something could happen at any moment, and we have to say at this point, we do need the nervous system to do that because, you know, if you're walking across a street and a car comes, you need your nervous system to move you out of the way.
Mm.
You know, stopping and doing nothing at any point, you know, can actually feel quite uncomfortable. So when I say that codependency lives in the body, I mean that literally. The relationship may be happening between two people, but the physical cost of constantly monitoring that relationship is, you know, carried by the, you know, individual. Now, I always bring people back to breathing. You know, breathing is the only thing you can carry around with you that's available 24 hours a day. And I when they feel activated, I often teach them just a little thing to do, which is, you know, 4 or 5 minutes of nasal breathing. Nasal breathing is much easier, you know, much healthier than through the mouth. Then to, when that's done, bring yourself back to awareness, which means, you know, just have a look around, see what you can see. Teaches your nervous system you're not trapped. And then just a little walk around. It takes, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, and then your nervous system starts to settle because it also realizes you're not trapped. Those little tools, you know, tend to work.
Absolutely. So when somebody is highly activated, why do you recommend regulating the body before trying to reason through the relationship problem? And what does that look like in practice, Nick?
Okay, because once we're highly activated, our thinking becomes much more focused on threats. You know, where's that threat coming from? And of course, our nervous system is designed to look for major threats. It's not designed to, you know, be involved in our relationships. Yeah, so that's not the ideal time to analyze the relationship, make major decisions, or send a long emotional message. So I prefer regulation first and then interpretation second. That doesn't have to involve anything elaborate. You know, like I said, slow the breathing, particularly exhalation. Relax the jaw and shoulders. Feel your feet against the floor. Take a short walk. Reduce stimulation, and which is very, very important. You can do that by putting the phone down. Most importantly, introduce some time between the feeling and the action. You know, once the nervous system has settled a little, we can start separating facts from interpretation. For example, they haven't replied for 2 hours is a fact. They're leaving me is an interpretation. You know, so when we're highly activated, these two things can feel exactly the same. So here we're not trying to suppress emotion. We're trying to become regulated enough that we have access to choice. That's the main goal.
Yes. And finally, Nick, what would you like our listeners to take away from today's conversation, particularly those who recognize some of these codependent patterns in themselves?
Well, I think what I'd like people to acknowledge and, you know, and try to work with is that, it's, as we said at the beginning, codependency isn't just about the way you behave. It's, you know, it's got tentacles right back into your past, and your whole nervous system has been fixed around, you know, some of the things that you experienced and endured in childhood. You know, it's actually quite interesting for me how I can see, you know, people who are highly intelligent, they've probably got very responsible jobs, but they act like children when they're in relationships. You know, so, you know, if you really want to understand codependency to a deeper level, you know, it's got to be awareness of where your codependency came from, what conditions you endured in childhood to create that situation. You know, bring it up to the present, look at behavior, yes, but also look at the role of the nervous system, and then work towards personal autonomy. Personal autonomy is independence, and many people think, okay, well, you know, independence means being distant or, you know, not being available for another person, but it actually means being yourself within a relationship and allowing yourself to have a relationship without giving up your whole life for them. Now, for a codependent, when you first say that to them, that sounds like, you know, getting to Mars or something like this. But if you can slowly work to it with them, you know, with You know, very small steps to begin with. You know, they get it. They're intelligent people. So that's where the groups that start on October the 4th really do go. It's the workshop is called Awareness to Action. It's 6 90-minute kind of sessions looking at exactly that in that stage. You know, childhood, you know, into the present, how the nervous system works, and then working towards, you know, what personal autonomy might look like. And, you know, I think that would be useful for anybody.
Absolutely. I think it would be extremely useful. So, Nick, thank you so much for coming back to the Healthy Debate Show and for sharing your valuable insights with us today. And what I think this conversation highlights and is so powerful is the codependency isn't simply about being too caring or struggling to say no or choosing the wrong relationships. Sometimes what looks like chasing or, as you mentioned, fixing or reassurance seeking or people pleasing on the outside may be connected to much deeper attempt to create safety on the inside. Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure having you back. If our listeners wish to connect, where can they find you? And please do share whether they'll be able to find how they can join the group if they wish to.
Well, the main place they can find me is on my blog, which is theonlinetherapist.blog. They can go onto the homepage, and at the top is a section called, you know, Work with Dr. Jenna. If they click on that, they'll find group therapy and all the details there. They can also download a program from there so they can sit and look at it. And of course, there's lots of other, you know, kind of resources on that site. Or they can contact me at my email, which is Safe Harbor. That's the English spelling of harbor, not the American with the U, at drnjenna.com. And yeah, and I'll be happy to talk to them.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for the fascinating conversation. And to everyone listening, thank you for joining us. To close today's show, I've chosen a timeless classic from Etta James, At Last. I'm Belinda Walia, and until next time, take care of yourself and each other.
Was wrapped up in clover.